Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, welcome to the McClifford Podcast with the Irish Examiner. And you're all very welcome again this week. Now, with the conflict in Gaza apparently entering a new phase, we thought it might be time to take stock. Last week, the Minister for Foreign Affairs, Micheál Martin, made a whistle-stop tour around the Middle East, and among those travelling with him was Irish Examiner political editor Elaine Loughlin. At home, there has been differing approaches to how this country is responding and should respond, particularly to the awful bombing that has rendered much of Gaza as little more than rubble and accounted for over 14,000 deaths at this stage. The government of this country appears to be more critical of Israel than any of the other EU states, but many in the opposition want the government to go further. So we've a lot of emotion, a lot of words, some might even say a lot of posturing, notwithstanding the genuine feelings of sympathy and empathy for the Palestinian people right now. And Sinn Féin has a strange conundrum on top of all that. Just recently reported that its US arm, Friends of Sinn Féin, has been extraordinarily quiet on the conflict. Presumably because maybe they're caught between stools. They're in the USA and at the same time they're part of Sinn Féin, and there'd be very differing attitudes between those two entities on the conflict as it stands. Anyway, to run the rule over all of that, we are joined now by the aforementioned Elaine Loughlin. Elaine, you're very welcome.
Thanks, Mick.
Elaine, we'll get to high diplomacy and what have you in a minute, but on a more basic level, a photograph of the tarnished while he was in Israel has kind of gone viral, and people may well have seen this on Twitter or other social media. It's been in some of the newspapers as well, including The Examiner. But it shows him pointing to a hole in the ceiling in a room in which he's standing, and he appears to be indicating the damage that was done. This, I think, was in a kibbutz in Israel. And there's been a certain amount of negative reaction to it. Some people suggesting he was kind of using a photo opportunity completely inappropriately. And others contrasting the relatively, and it is damaged, it's a rocket coming through a ceiling anyway, but compared to what's been going on in Gaza, the relatively minor damage compared to the collapse of building upon building in Gaza as a result of the Israeli bombing. Well, we have the inside track on this because Elaine Loughlin was present for that photograph, and even more than that, I believe, Elaine.
Yes, Mick, and I think this is really a lesson on how, you know, we say always that a picture can paint a thousand words, but I think in the days of social media and sharing and manipulation, a photo can really be used to paint a thousand words that are not reflective of the reality of how that picture was taken and the context of it. And as you said, I was in the room when that picture was taken. And in fact, I, hands up, I'm the person who took that picture, contrary to what has been said online. And I know even I was speaking to a number of TDs and politicians in Leinster House this week who were very interested, obviously, in the trip to Israel, to the West Bank and to Egypt over a whirlwind number of days with the tánaiste, Micheál Martin. And in speaking about this, it was noteworthy to say that one politician was commenting on Micheál Martin's trip and said, God, well, that picture that he put up on his social media, really, what was he thinking? And I had to stop them there and say, that picture did not go up on Micheál Martin's social media. I took that picture. I took it on my phone. It was a quick pick. It wasn't a posed picture. And it's in that context of, you know, images can be shared and manipulated and reshared again and again and again so many times that actually getting to the source of where it came from or how it came about can be almost impossible for especially members of the general public who are flicking through whether it's Instagram, whether it's X or other social media platforms. And it's very easy to distort reality. And just to give you a bit of background, that picture, as I said, which was quickly taken on my iPhone and sent back to my digital desk, the examiner's digital desk, it has to be said, with a video, which also was posted on the Irish Examiner social media channels with that picture. And the video is obviously, it gives far more context. It pans around the room, but that video has not gone viral, which is interesting in itself. And at the time, Micheál Martin had been shown the damage done by a rocket that was fired from Gaza in those attacks after the October 7th attack. It was in the town of Zerderot, which is only a mile across the border from Gaza. And he was shown the fact that a bit of the missile had got stuck in the roof, essentially between the ceiling and the roof. Now, a number in the party hadn't been there when that had been pointed out, and he was then pointing this out to others who were also in that residential building, that home that was partly destroyed. And it was at that point I happened to be on the shoulder of the person that he was speaking to, directly next to him, took the quick pic with my phone. Now, when you look at it, it perhaps some may interpret it as him looking directly down the camera. Just happened that way. He certainly wasn't looking at me, wasn't really aware that I was taking the picture, because, you know, there were a number of officials there, his own officials, Israeli officials, and then a small group of reporters in that that home. And obviously members of the family were there as well to describe what happened on the day. And it really took off from there. And we've seen how it's been used, and some would say abused, online to promote certain narratives that, I said, really did not reflect how it was taken and the situation that it was taken in.
Yeah, that's very interesting, Elaine, because like a lot of other people, and I'm even in the media, the kind of image that you're suggesting was erroneously projected there, I bought into that myself. Now, I didn't think there was anything particularly wrong with it, but it most certainly looked like a posed photograph of the tarnished, making a point that he was here at the scene of some of the rockets and what have you, in a way that politicians do. It's part of their brief. But as you say, the reality was completely different. And what really goes to the heart of that, I would think, is you posted a video at the same time, but the video didn't go viral because presumably the video had a lot more context, and that would have given the true story of what was occurring, rather than this, which could and has been manipulated for people's own ends.
Exactly. And I suppose you can't make a meme out of a video. You can't, you know, add bits and pieces and mark up videos in the same way that you can take a picture and perhaps, you know, edit it, add a few bits and pieces to it as well, and share it and pass it on. And of course, once it is passed on in that way on social media, you see how it spreads like wildfire, and perhaps explaining the context to it is almost impossible. And I think one of the criticisms as well that was being mounted in the context of sharing that picture was the fact that Micheál Martin went to Israel. As I said, he also did visit that same day the West Bank and had been to Egypt the day before. And we do know that in the context of this conflict, Egypt has a key role to play. I think Egypt is one of a few states that perhaps, if anyone is going to be able to talk to Hamas or members of Hamas, it is Egyptian officials. And they've had those type of links over the years across the border into Gaza with Hamas. So I think Micheál Martin put particular emphasis on going to Egypt and speaking to his Egyptian counterparts. But he did meet with the Israelis, and it could be said that the Israeli officials were only delighted to have a foreign minister there so they could show him around towns like Zerderot. He also was brought to that kibbutz, the Biri kibbutz, which we know Emily Hand was last seen in, and there were pictures taken, and like mine, some of them spread wider and further than others. But he also got in the room with his Israeli counterparts and said things that they really did not want to hear. You know, he stressed the need for a humanitarian ceasefire immediately. He stressed the need for a two-state solution. And he also pointed out to the absolute trauma and devastation that is being inflicted on the people of Gaza, literally within, you know, a kilometre of some of the areas that he was in while he was speaking to both Eli Cohen, the Israeli foreign minister, but also the mayor of Zerderot and others who hopefully you would imagine will be relaying those messages further up the chain to Israeli officials and government members, and certainly didn't pull back in putting Ireland's case forward and stating that we want a two-state solution. We are in favour of that. And also, as I said, pointing out the loss of life on a just an unimaginable scale now at this stage in Gaza.
Yeah, and it is interesting, the week that was in it, Elaine, because there was a contrast. And the contrast was, Micheál Martin was over there, as you say. He was engaging with all sides. As you say, some people in this country, because of a general affinity to the Palestinians, and it's long standing. But in some minds, some people want that to translate as having absolutely no engagement with the Israelis, which I'd find kind of ironic coming from this country, because the one thing we know about when you've conflict and you've sides, the one thing you need to keep doing is dialogue. You need to have some kind of peace up. Yet, that would seem to be the position of some people on what's described as the left, and you can debate what exactly the left is these days. But the contrast between that and Martin over there doing the diplomacy, making the hard yards and that kind of thing, how would you say he performed, and I mean that word in the best sense in terms of his role as a politician, as an honest broker and that kind of thing. How would you say he performed during that trip in terms of his engagements with the various parties?
Well, certainly, as I've mentioned before, that meeting with the mayor of Zerderot was in a packed room in the town hall. There were about 22 officials around the boardroom, and then a number of media, including myself, got in to line the walls of what was a very stuffy wall. But there was a palpable sense of tension in that room, and the mayor started off by asking Eli Cohen, "Are these guys with us?" And that kind of set the tone. Now, Eli Cohen explained that, yes, these were the Irish officials that were coming to see and to hear. And Micheál Martin subsequently said that he was here to see and to hear and to witness some of the atrocities that went on in that October 7th Hamas attack. But equally pointed, again, as I said before, to what is going on across the border. And when you were there as well, Mick, these are communities that are very much aware of what Israel has been doing since those October 7th attacks.
When you said, "Are these guys with us?" was the inference there is these people are Irish and we have a suspicion as to whether the Irish are with us, or was it a more general thing?
Yes, I think that is the case. Like Israel, you know, you go back to 2021 when this doll came together, united and voted to condemn the illegal annexation by Israel of parts of the West Bank. So that signal has been out there. And even long before that, I think politicians from across the political spectrum had been united in their view of what is going on in Israel and Palestine for many, many decades now, not just recent years and the conflict. So I think Ireland would have been viewed even long before the October 7th attacks as certainly pro-Palestinian in their stance. Now, I think some would argue that being pro-Palestinian doesn't mean that you are anti-Israeli or anti-Semitic. It just means that you are fighting for a people who really have been targeted and subjected to a level of, I suppose, containment in some ways over many years that Irish people just cannot agree with.
Yeah, and he had engagements as well on the West Bank. And I'm just curious, did you detect anything there that people in the West Bank, Palestinians, had any sense of affinity with the Irish delegation, and the flip side of the attitudes to the Israelis, or were they just another Western country coming in here kind of thing?
Well, I think that's one thing, and it's not just this most recent trip, but I think every Irish government politician that has visited Israel is always conscious that they visit the Palestinian Authority as well in the West Bank, and we make a point of that. And it was interesting as well, you know, going across that border from Jerusalem into Ramallah, we went through a very quiet, deserted crossing, it has to be said, and usually that crossing would be very busy with Palestinians, and there's about 110,000 Palestinians who have work permits to cross that border each day to go into Israel and Israeli settlements, and they work in everything from construction, they're nurses in hospitals, they're teachers in Israeli schools, and that has all stopped since October 7th. And these are people who are supporting maybe 9, 10, 11, 12 members of their family and extended family, and that's source of income has now been cut off overnight. So we are all seeing the bombardment of Gaza, and there are, you know, 400 bombs going off, or have been 400 bombs going off each day in Gaza since this started. But in the West Bank, I think the screw has been turned and tightened up a notch significantly. And I think I saw online a really good comment in recent days, and it said, while Gaza is under fire, the West Bank smoulders. And it really is a case of, you know, between cutting off a source of income through not letting Palestinians cross that border to go to work in Israel every day, through the ramping up of bulldozing houses, and also the raids that are going on in the West Bank every day. There's around 40 Israeli raids daily since October 7th. And they're on family homes, and they can go on for hours. You know, it can be entire communities that are impacted by these raids, and you know, you've seen kind of houses destroyed, you've seen cars burnt out by Israeli armed forces when they go in and carry out those raids.
Yeah, you're right. It is absolutely insidious. I mean, what's going on in Gaza at the moment is a humanitarian disaster, and the constant bombing of civilians is just completely and utterly unacceptable on any human level. But what's been going on in the West Bank is nothing more than a land grab. And you have now 700,000 Israelis living in the West Bank and just taking land and moving in there, and a lot of them are religious, I don't know if fanatics is the right word to use, that believe they have some biblical connection to it. More of them are going in there for a lifestyle choice. But what they're doing, more than anything, is putting further away the day when you can have a genuine two-state solution, and that the West Bank could form the basis for the Palestinian state, because they're in there, they're displacing people, they're increasing their numbers. It's really insidious. And as you say, when the focus is on the far side of the country in Gaza, all that kind of stuff is going on now all the time. And that is as much the legacy of Netanyahu as anything, that kind of thing that's going on, rather than going back. And I know it's 30 years now and more before the two-state solution appeared to be the basis for a peace agreement. But it's really pushing that further out. It's really, really bad, that whole scenario.
To know what's really happening, subscribe to the Irish Examiner today at irishexaminer.com/subscribe.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Elaine, since you came back, you'll have noticed the shenanigans in the Dáil. Well, I mean, maybe it's a bit unfair to call them shenanigans. People have genuine feelings. But I would have to say what strikes me, and I'd be just very curious about your opinion. On one side, the government are being practical, and I think, to be fair to them, are reflecting the feelings of an awful lot of people here. Yet large sections of the opposition would appear to genuinely believe they're not going far enough and they want them to go a lot further. But were we to go to the kind of lengths that the likes of People Before Profit want us to go to, and Sinn Féin to a lesser degree, do we start running into trouble? Do we start negating any kind of leverage we have? And do we move away from other EU countries with which we're closely aligned?
Yeah, and that's the thing. And we had this discussion, I suppose, at the outbreak of the war, Russia's attack on Ukraine, where there were calls for the expulsion of the Russian ambassador. And again, the same argument was made by the government was you have to keep these people in the room. You have to keep those communication links open. And we do have Irish citizens still in Gaza. And I think the Irish government are very conscious of that. And obviously, I think Micheál Martin has pointed to the fact that it's no coincidence that he was speaking to his Egyptian counterparts, that he was in Egypt when the first group of 23 Irish citizens crossed the border at Rafah into Egypt. And this has been the culmination of many, many weeks of phone calls, of meetings, of discussions, of diplomats talking to their counterparts in Egypt, in Israel, in the West Bank, in Qatar, in the US, across the Middle East, on a sometimes hourly basis, to make sure that those Irish people were on that list initially and then got out. And obviously we do still have a small number still in Gaza, and I said, but if you cut those links with Israel, you know, at that time especially anyway, I suppose it would have made the act of getting those people out very, very difficult, if not impossible. So there is the argument for that. I think members of the government, and we do know that Ireland went further than the majority of European countries at the very start of this, and it does seem like other European nations are now coming closer, if not meeting what the Irish have been saying. But I think within government as well, a lot of people probably within government would love to go, if not as far as some members of the opposition, would certainly like to go further than the stance that we have now. But diplomacy comes into that, and what you can say while you're in power, and you have to speak to your international powers versus what you can say when you're in opposition. There is that gap there. And I think probably one of the people who's gone furthest is perhaps Minister Simon Harris, who said in the Dáil last week and reiterated again this week that you can't build peace on the graves of children. A really strong statement, I think, from him, and I think probably something that privately a lot in government may be saying, may be agreeing with, but publicly can't possibly go that far now. It'll be interesting, though, there is an EU summit coming up at the start of December, and obviously Taoiseach Leo Varadkar will be at that. It'll be interesting to see how far he goes and how far he tries to push his European counterparts on possibly even, you know, we have the call for a humanitarian ceasefire at the moment. Will he try and get his fellow leaders down the road of pushing for a full ceasefire, of condemning Israel in even stronger terms, and see, you know, if he can actually bring a few other countries along with him? We do know the likes of Spain are probably of the same mindset as ourselves right now, and maybe a number of states can bandy together to put more pressure on those who are possibly lagging and are less critical of Israel up until now. So I think that's one to watch in the coming time.
Yeah, and another element to the opposition at the moment, just emerged there, I saw it in the last few days, about a bit of a dilemma Sinn Féin have, and that is the Friends of Sinn Féin, their US arm, brilliant fundraising organisation, fantastic for raising funds for the party, and contributes to, I think, the party status. It's generally accepted as the wealthiest party on this island, but they have been extremely quiet about the conflict, whereas the mothership, Sinn Féin here and in the Dáil and what have you, have been extremely vocal. And I was down at the Sinn Féin Ardèche, as you were yourself, and the tumultuous reception that the Palestinian ambassador got there was really a reflection of how much the Palestinian cause is there within the psyche of Sinn Féin. Yet at the same time, their US arm is very quiet. And you have to suspect that's largely because the kind of line that Sinn Féin have would not go down at all well in the United States.
Yes, and even, I suppose, politically, Sinn Féin are gearing up for government in Dublin after the next general election. And that's fairly clear and I think almost expected within the Sinn Féin ranks at this stage. And it was interesting at the beginning of this conflict, or this latest bout, shall we call it, that Sinn Féin stopped short of calling for the expulsion of the Israeli ambassador in Ireland. And it was only after a number of days, and we saw Mary Lou MacDonald go up to Belfast, where I think the party was under significantly more heat than down here at the time, that she then changed that and did call for the expulsion of the ambassador, and since then has been doing the same. They didn't put that in their motion last week. Sinn Féin did support another motion which did call for the expulsion, but it is worth keeping an eye on, because I think definitely Mary Lou MacDonald is looking at what is achievable if she were to be in government, and the stance that she takes now will obviously be looked at and will be compared and contrast with what she does as a future Taoiseach, if that's what happens after the next general election.
Yeah, Elaine, just to go back briefly to your time over in the Middle East, and because, again, as I say, and I think it's totally accepted, the affinity we have for the Palestinians, I think it would also be fair to say, notwithstanding the awful actions of the Israeli Defence Force at the moment, but I just wonder, do we in this country have any appreciation of the psyche of the Israelis? And from where we're looking, they look like they're just hate the Palestinians and they're out to, people use the phrase genocide a lot. But I get the impression that a mentality that's there, particularly since October the 8th, is one whereby in their minds, they're back to the centuries of pogroms and what have you, and Hamas quite obviously have stated blindly they're out to wipe Israel off the face of the earth, notwithstanding their complete inability to do so militarily. But I get the impression that the Israelis, their emotions are so high at the moment because of October 7th that they don't see what's going on in Gaza through the same kind of eyes that we do. Do you have any kind of insight in that from your time over there?
Yeah, and I think you're probably right there. There is that kind of memory and trauma that has been handed down through the generations amongst Israelis. But I think one thing that has been said by the Taoiseach here in the Dáil this week is he fears that they're now blinded by hate. And it definitely struck me when we were in that kibbutz, the Be'eri kibbutz, and the tarnish that was being shown around family homes that have been left there after being firebombed, and you know, you see a child's comb on the floor, you see the remnants of dinner on the table, and these are families that are not coming back because they were taken out, and this was an atrocity, and then many of them are still being held hostage in Gaza. So there is that real trauma, and it's visceral. But at the same time, as we were being told about that day by a number of survivors who managed to get into safe rooms and lock themselves away for hours before the IDF came eventually to get them out, they were telling us about the trauma, and Micheál Martin was shown pictures as well of the devastation and the aftermath. There were bombs going off across the border, and they were so close that you could feel the ground tremble underneath. And for a number of us, it was actually difficult to concentrate on what the survivors were actually telling us, because that palpable feeling underneath our feet, and both the sheer sound of what was going on across the border. And I have an 8 minute recording on my phone, and across those entire 8 minutes it was a continuous boom in the background from what was going on, and it just shows the level of hatred there must be when people cannot feel for neighbours that are literally a few kilometres across a wire fence or a concrete wall, and cannot associate the absolute trauma that they must be going through. They cannot see, despite the fact that they can hear the bombs, they can feel the bombs, and they can see the smoke plumes in the air, they cannot see their neighbours as human beings. they don't associate their own trauma, or they cannot kind of, I suppose, relate to the fact that they are going through trauma, but their neighbours are also going through trauma. And we see the videos time and time again, and I know people scroll through them and you don't maybe look at them all now at this stage, but I saw one this morning and it really hit home with me, and it was of a child. She was probably about 6 or 7 years of age, and it wasn't the most graphic of images that I've seen, Mick, but she was sitting on a gurney and it was clear that there were two other children on that hospital gurney with her. She was covered in debris. She had, you know, blood on her face. It didn't look like she was badly injured, thankfully. But she was there. Her hair was matted. Her face was grey. Her clothes were covered in debris. And it kind of struck me, she had no parent there to wipe her face. She probably had no one there as well to change her clothes. And I kind of wondered, how long is she going to sit in those clothes alone? And we've heard the acronym now as well of WCNCF. That's a Wounded Child, No Surviving Family. And it's just devastating. It's hard to comprehend what is happening in Gaza now. And I think the Taoiseach as well, when he was on the Israeli side, the other side of the border, he mentioned and warned that what Israel is doing now is only going to create another generation of radicalised young people, because they are seeing, they are feeling, they are grieving right now, and that grief will turn into anger. And I think Israel probably should think long and hard, but unfortunately they don't seem to be thinking long and hard about the consequences of their actions right now, and this is just going to create another generation who are so blinded by hate, probably on both sides of that border, that this conflict will unfortunately go on for a long time to come.
It's so true. It is awful when you see that kind of thing, and when you see the premature babies that were born in those hospitals in Gaza, and you just wonder, good God, what being brought into the world, what prospects do they have being born into that kind of a situation? And I think you're absolutely right there. Unless something is sorted out politically, and it can only be politically, you are inevitably going to see massive radicalisation of an awful lot of Palestinians in relation to that. Elaine, one final thing before you go, and it's foreign policy again, but a slightly different vein. This week, of course, Micheál Martin, fresh back from the Middle East, and he announces in the Dáil the ending, or he hopes he's going to legislate for the ending of this triple lock, and the triple lock being the three tests, so to speak, that have to be passed for Irish Defence Forces to be engaged anywhere, one being the Dáil, one being the government, and the third being the UN Security Council. And I think something along these lines might have been recommended by the consultative forum that was on recently. But one way or the other, he's decided we're going to get rid of the UN element of that. And there's been a lot of loud opposition to that so far. Do you see this becoming any kind of a problem for the government? Or is it something that will just go through with, you know, the usual kind of bit of opposition here and there, but ultimately will just take the course through the houses?
I think this is something that the opposition will do everything in their power to certainly slow down, if not stop, because it did come quite unexpected, it has to be said, on Wednesday evening as the Taoiseach addressed the Dáil on those security forums that were that took place over the summer in Galway, Cork and Dublin around our security, cyber security, was neutrality, all of those type of issues were discussed at those forums. And he said that basically the triple lock system is not really working anymore for Ireland, and that is because of that effective UN veto, which gives the five permanent members of the UN security a say as to whether we take part in foreign peacekeeping missions. And he pointed to the fact that there are a number of countries who probably are happy to veto those, China, the UK and the US, and of course Russia are among the permanent members of the Security Council. And also, the Taoiseach pointed out in the Dáil that it took 6 weeks for that Security Council to make a statement and call for a humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza. So I think there are a lot of things that need to be sorted out with the UN Security Council, but whether or not removing the triple lock is the way to do that, or is the way to respond to that, I think the opposition will be very, very vehemently against doing that, and it really remains to see how far the government want to push on this. The Taoiseach did say that he's already got his officials in the Department of Defence to start drafting this legislation. So it seems to be something that they want to get done in the short time now that they have left in government and get over the line.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it advances. And I suppose in some ways what it is a nuanced approach to something being brought in or being attempted at a time when so much of politics is seen in tribal fashion or is in black and white, and as a result could well run into some trouble, but something we'll definitely keep an eye on. Elaine, listen, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Mick.
That's Elaine Loughlin, folks, Irish Examiner political editor, and you can read her column every Saturday in the Irish Examiner. Thanks to Elaine. Thanks also, as always, to JJ Fernan, our engineer. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. We'll be back again next week. Take it easy.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.